Check. Okay.
This is the Barbershop Show, live from Carter's Barbershop, 3622 West Surmac, in Chicago's North Lawndale neighborhood, with your host, WBEZ's Richard Steele.
Well, this is the Barbershop Show. I'm Richard Steele. We're at Carter's Barbershop in Chicago's North Lawndale neighborhood. Very special show today. We're going to later on talk about some forecasts for 2017 with a couple of expert journalists. But before we do that, as per suggestion by my producer, Ayanna Contreras, today's show is also being done in recognition of my 75th anniversary on the planet.
Hey, happy birthday.
So I have some very special guests with me today. Mavis Staples is here. Hello. Check it out. How about some applause, ladies and gentlemen?
I'll take you there. Good morning.
The Duke of Earl, Gene Chandler, is here. How about some applause for Gene Chandler?
I thank you.
So these are some personal friends of mine, and I appreciate the fact that you guys took time to come by the shop today. Let me just say a couple of things about each of these incredible people. Mavis was recently honored at the Kennedy Center in New York and has gotten just about every honor in the music business, a Grammy for a solo recording in 2010 for the album You Are Not Alone, a music career that has connected with just about everybody in music, Mahalia Jackson, Prince, Dizzy Gillespie, and Bob Dylan. Staple Singers had their first hit record in 1957, Uncloudy Day. She has not stopped singing since, nonstop, all the way. Staple Singers joined Dr. King in the Civil Rights Movement of the early 1960s, recorded a number of inspirational songs like March Up Freedom's Highway. Then came the big national hits, Respect Yourself, I'll Take You There, Let's Do It Again. Later CD is called Living on a High Note, and we'll hear something from that a little bit later. And be sure to check out the HBO documentary called Mavis, which is pretty incredible. I saw it twice. And I should mention, we both went to Parker High School at the same period of time back in the day. She was there before me. Let me just say that. Another salsa, Gene Chandler.
That was not necessary.
The Duke of Earl, he went to Inglewood. And so, that's a Southside thing. Not a big deal. The Duke of Earl was a 1962 gold record recipient, over a million copies in less than a month. Everybody knows Duke. Hey, everybody in the barbershop, can I get y'all to do this one time? Everybody who remembers this? On a count of three. One, two, three. Duke of Earl.
He's here.
Duke of Earl, Gene Chandler, performing in a top hat, cane, cape, and monocle. He wore that in the 1962 movie called Don't Knock the Twist with Chubby Checker. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. He also recorded a hit record called Rainbow that he recorded three times, 1962, 65, and 80, and all three times the record was a hit. That's got to be, Mavis, what do you think about that?
That's a bad Montana.
And ironically, as we do this show from Carter's Barbershop, Gene owns a barbershop in the South Suburbs called The Duke.
Yesterday's Jazz.
Right. And said to me, you asked me to come to the barbershop. I got a barbershop. What's up with that? You know what I mean? So I appreciate in the South Suburbs, right?
Right.
Appreciate the fact that you came in. Also, I should mention, Gene, you had a street named after you here in Chicago on the south side of Inglewood.
Yes.
Where was it?
59th Street, 59 Racine. It's called Gene Duke Chandler Way.
All of that.
God, man.
All right.
Honorable. Okay.
I should also mention that Gene was also the undisputed star of the first show in the doo-wop series on public television. Mavis, you ever hear this story about Gene? Did you ever see that the series, the first one he was in?
Doo-wop 50.
The doo-wop, with T.J. Lubinsky.
Oh, yes, I did.
Well, Gene, he made an entrance like from the second balcony. Everybody's came on the stage, you know. So when it was time for the Duke of Earl, he comes out of the back of the theater.
Oh, man.
People went crazy. Unbelievable. Look, let me just say to both of you all, because you all been in this business for so long and have managed to maintain for so incredibly long. For you, Mavis, have you two ever been on the same shows? I know you're both in at the Regal.
Yeah.
But
we were in the Apollo.
And the Apollo.
Uptown Theater.
Yeah. On the street at 47?
He got so big, couldn't get him no more.
Oh, Gene?
Yeah. He would only hang out in Las Vegas.
As a matter of fact, didn't you one time hold the record for attendance at the Regal?
Yeah, I still hold it. Well, because it's torn down right. now. Yeah. Yeah, I hold an attendance record for the Regal Theater.
And that was that when you did the, this was a live?
It was in the 60s, early 60s.
So you did the Rainbow Live was 65, right?
Was at the Regal.
That was at the Regal.
Also,
oh,
yes.
Man. So big time. So tell me a little bit something, Mavis. Now you've both of you guys have traveled everywhere and done this music everywhere. Give me what might be one of your most outstanding experiences in this business. Either strange, funny, crazy, whatever.
All of that.
What got me was Mavis, my name. I don't know any Mavises. We go to Johannesburg. Every lady, every other lady on the street is named Mavis.
In Johannesburg, in South Africa?
South Africa. And the men would say, Mavis, my wife is Mavis. My daughter is Mavis. There was even a girl on the show with us named Mavis. And to show you how these folk were, they're so proud of their people. They said, Mavis, South Africa, I've seen that Mavis from USA, you know. And Pop said, Mavis, don't you feel bad? I said, Dad, I don't feel bad. I don't feel bad. That's just the way they are. That's the way they want to be proud of their own. And they well should.
Mavis.
But that was one of the times that blew my mind, the fact that I was walking into all these Mavises. And all these years, I hadn't known any Mavis over here. There's a lady that sings jazz, Mavis Rivers, but I don't know her. I know she's here.
Well, you're the only Mavis that we know, so, right, Gene?
Right, only one.
What about you, Gene? I know you've had all kinds of experiences over the years, and you've been every place, performed everywhere, and seen everything, and done
not everything.
Well,
not everywhere.
Mostly.
I've been to 70 countries, okay. But that's not everywhere. A lot more countries. The only reason I remember that, they were talking about the Secretary of State, how many countries that they've traveled in.
Yeah.
I said, God, I've been into a few, and that's when I started adding up, and I've been in about 70 countries, yeah, including South Africa.
Did you go
Africa.
To China?
Yeah.
That's one we've never been to China.
When I went to China, it wasn't to perform, though. It was to visit.
Is
some of these
right?
places
Close
I visit. Okay. Some of these places I went to visit, and then there were others that I performed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hold
okay.
your point for a minute. I'm going to do this, and I want you to think about that experience I asked you about that was unusual, unique, crazy, one you want to forget or remember. You got that?
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, this is the Barbershop Show produced by Vocalo 91.1 FM. You can join the conversation by tweeting us with the hashtag Barbershop Show. Right now we're talking to two of my very good friends, the recording artist Gene Chandler and Mavis Staples. So, okay, so Gene, about an experience that you want to share with us, or maybe you don't want to share with us, but we're asking you to do it anyway.
Not really, because there's so many different experiences. If you've been in 70 countries in all 51 states or something in the United States,
sure.
been to all
Absolutely.
Of them. Yeah, so there's a lot of different experiences as we...
Give us one.
Yeah.
It's like well, outstanding.
When I went to South Africa, I did go see the witch doctor.
Okay. You went to see a witch doctor?
Yeah. Well, it was a big sign up there. The witch doctor, right? I kept passing by. There was a big, giant stuffed gorilla sitting there. And I told the guy who was taking us around, I want to go see the witch doctor. And because, I mean, as growing up as a kid, the witch doctor was always the one they went to decide whether this person was going to die or not or whatever.
Yes.
Supposed to be the wise person. And actually, it comes down from centuries. It's passed on to that particular family, to the next one. And he had about 9 wives, and they came out playing bongo drums and doing an African song for the group of us. The two tons of funds went over there with me.
Is that right?
The Weather Girls.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they
right.
used to be sitting behind
yeah.
Sylvia. I mean,
yeah.
Not Sylvia. Sylvester. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And they were the group that was over there with me, and then they added some local African groups for the show. And we was in Durban, Johannesburg, of course, and then we went into the towns. The people were so beautiful. All the kids ran and jumped on us when we got off the bus.
Uh-huh.
They fed us everywhere. You know, hospitality was fantastic in those little towns and what have you. So, and the witch doctor, he had his wisdom, you know. He told us a few things about ourselves, and he was on the button. So they're really not the bad guys.
Okay. Yeah.
They're just
part
the ones who have been there from centuries and have a lot of wisdom
uh-huh.
about it.
Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned about the wise. Mavis has an interesting story. I'll only touch on it briefly. When you were somewhere, you all got working in Africa, And in Ghana. It was in Ghana when the king asked you to be one of his wives.
Yes. Wife number four.
Oh, okay. Did he give you some bongos?
I wouldn't allow it. I told him, I said, wife number four? I have to be number one. Chief Nana. And that was in Ghana.
He sent somebody to
He sent, look, he sent the white man to my hotel. This was unusual. This was in the 70s. And he had a note for me. Miss Staples, the Chief Nana, he would like to see you. I read the note, and I gave him the note back. He said, but he would like to see you. I said, well, I'll see him tonight. We're having dinner at his palace or wherever it was. And he was, it was beautiful. This man was draped in silk, you know. And he told me, Mavis, I would like for you to be wife number four. I will treat you very nice. And one of them told Pops, said, Papa Staples, I'll give you 11 cows for Mavis. Give me Mavis' hand. I'll give you 11. There's 11 cows. Mavis, I think I'll take those cows.
Look, we got to wrap this up. Let me ask you this. And I know you have I looked at your schedule coming up. You got a lot of touring to do. I mean,
yeah.
It's unbelievable.
All through July already.
If you can, in a sentence or so, give me a wrap-up about you're still committed to the whole idea of civil rights, and now more than ever, things are very, very, very serious.
Mm-hmm, indeed. I see the news today, and I feel like I'm still in the 60s. You know, so I pray a lot. And with what's happening with our world today, with our, you know, I don't want to call no names, but it's a spooky time. We're living in people are having to look behind them, can't say certain things, you know, so.
You're still committed.
I'm still committed. But the freedom songs, I feel like I'm free now, you know, but what's happening today, you know, Pops used to tell the songwriters, if you want to write for the Staple Singers, read the headlines. And I check the headlines, you know, so I've got to start writing songs now about love. Come together. Love one another.
We'll look forward to that. Gene Chandler, one of the things that people don't know about you is when you do the food baskets thing around Christmas.
And Thanksgiving.
And that's been kind of a mission for you, right?
Thanksgiving is turkeys. At Christmas is turkeys, food baskets, toys, clothing, Christmas trees, and that kind of thing.
Two artists who give back. I appreciate having you both here today at the Barbershop. Gene Chandler, the Duke of Earl, and Mavis Staples, the Queen of Everything. How about a hand for these wonderful folks?
Happy birthday, Richard. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Richard. Happy birthday to you.
Okay, doesn't get much better than that. When we come back, look at 2017 through the eyes of some very experienced journalists. We'll be right back.
All right.
It's our time at the Regal. Young man went out and made a name for himself. Has been on every record-breaking show in the Regal Theater in the last 2 years. Ladies and gentlemen, the star of our show, how about a nice warm round of applause to welcome Mr. Gene Chandler.
Thank you so very much.
is the Barbershop Show. I'm Richard Steele. We're here at Carter's Barbershop at North Lawndale. Happy New Year, everybody. This is a time of year when it seems like just about everybody is taking stock of what this past year brought them. And then people start to set out goals for the upcoming year and decide which habits they need to break. You know, the New Year's resolutions. After everything that the city of Chicago has been through this year, we thought we'd do Chicago a favor and suggest a few resolutions for the city and talk about some things that happened, just a few things that lead into 2017, and there's a lot that has happened in the city. Joining us for that conversation is Ben Jarofsky, a reporter with the Chicago Reader, Monroe Anderson, veteran journalist and commentator, and John W. Fountain, columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you, Richard.
Everybody's been here before, so you know that we, generally speaking, have like a conversation. So whenever you want to jump in and say whatever you want to say, it's okay. Pay no attention to the fact that today is my 75th anniversary on the planet. You know what I mean? That was a suggestion made by my producer who said we should do that. That's the only reason I'm doing that today. You know,
Monroe's going to sing a song.
Yeah, right, exactly. You
know? Ben, don't sing.
No, okay. He's got to run every radio away.
He's a writer, not a singer.
One thing I'd like to note about issues in Chicago, the mayor, Emanuel, has already made a New Year's resolution to hire nearly 1,000 new police officers. So there are various thoughts on that plan, because Chicago, obviously, at this point, the issue of violence within the community and also the violence as it relates to bad conduct by police officers. The city also promoted 135 new detectives, and they hope that will improve the low homicide clearance rate. Around 20% of homicide cases in Chicago are solved, and only about 3% for non-lethal shootings. So what about all of that? Monroe, your thoughts on the whole issue of the mayor hiring the 1,000 new police officers and making a stab at trying to reduce the level of violent crime in Chicago.
It sounds good on paper, but I'm not sure that 1,000 cops is the problem. I think it's the way the police are being used that may be the problem. I mean, there's still very much too much the occupying force in the black community instead of the servers and protectors. And so I they're trying to move, I think, at least I hope, they're trying to move more into being friends of the community instead of the wardens of the community. But some cops may help, but I just don't know about that.
All right, well, John W. Fountain, I mentioned you next because this is from the opinion page of your newspaper, the Chicago Sun-Times, and they did a piece in the editorial section called Learn from New York on Curbing Gun Violence, and they had some suggestions in here. They said New York is, in New York, the aim is to lock up dangerous people. The program there also includes intensive social services, too, so it's not just like the one thing. And they also say by pushing intelligence-driven prosecutions, that's what it's called in New York, the New York District Attorney's Office strives to be less reactive, simply prosecuting whoever the cops pick up, and more proactive, identifying which offenders are the biggest menace to a neighborhood and making sure they don't slip through the cracks when they get arrested the next time.
I think that is certainly part of it. I just don't think that hiring 1,000 or 10,000 new police officers is going to solve the issue. People talk about community policing. It's a term that I think has been lost. And unless you sensitize police officers to the communities that they're policing, for instance, if you hire 10,000 new police officers and they see black people as all the same, they believe their perception is that we're all criminals. They can't differentiate between young men who happen to be just standing on the corner and young men who are actually involved in gangs or illegal activity. That's an issue. If police officers still stop me on the street and don't talk to me with respect like I'm decent, like I'm a human being, then that's still an issue. And so I think that in addition to hiring police officers, they've got to deal with this issue of this divide between the community and police. And I don't know, I was born on the west side of Chicago. I don't ever remember there being a good relationship between the black African-American community and police. Now, if I'm wrong, somebody please correct me, but I don't think it was...
Not here.
No, well, I
can't correct you.
I don't think there's a correction on that. Ben Jarofsky?
Well, I mean,
just to deal with the central point that you stated, that they're hiring 1,000 more police, the reality is that we've lost about that many police through retirement and attrition. Right. So this is just a numbers game, a PR game, Richard. And that's all. And the issue of criminal justice under the 5 years of Mayor Rahm's tenure in Chicago, my humble opinion, it has been a PR game. It was ignored for first 4 years until the Laquan McDonald video was released. And then suddenly the mayor realized that he had an issue of crime and bad relations with police. I remember his first comment was, well, you know, we're dealing with the aftermath of 50 years of history and legacy, but we were already 4 years into his term. He hadn't done anything on it. So it's catch-up time in Chicago in many ways. If you not catch-up like the stuff you put
no,
on.
No, I hear you. I hear you. You know. So, you know, as moving
and,
forward.
And with New York, yeah, go ahead. One thing, New York pretends like they target the bad guys, but what they have been doing until a court order stopped them was if you happen to be a young and a person of color, then you were stopped.
You mean under Giuliani's approach to law and order?
That yeah, was yeah, but it, yeah, exactly.
Stop and frisk.
But you know but what? It is significant that he hires the detectives, don't you think? I mean, you have to solve crimes.
Yes. Oh, sure.
People have to be held accountable. So if what is the – I forget what the rate is. I read this somewhere about the number of murders that happens and nobody is arrested, nobody's prosecuted for it. Then there's no accountability. It's as though it's not a crime. So
I'd like to see the numbers of these new detectives, how many are black. Because when I was press secretary, there were very
I should mention
few,
that you were press secretary to Mayor Sawyer.
To Mayor Sawyer, okay. Yeah. There were very few black detectives because that's where you control everything. It's not the beat cop that does it. The detective really decides who gets arrested and what have you. That's where the power is in the police department.
Okay, well, let me ask you this, all of you, this question. One of the responses has always been, as far as detective work is concerned and solving cases, is that one of the problems is that there's very little help from the community that's affected. In the black community, the whole issue of don't tell is a big issue. And so part of it is because it's part of the tradition. The other part of it is fear. You know, if you tell on somebody.
It's also if you don't have black detectives, then they are as comfortable talking to white detectives.
Okay,
but I always find that interesting, this whole don't tell, when it's applied to the black community, but it's never applied to
the police department.
Community.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, this is the Barbershop Show produced by Vocalo 91.1 FM. You can join the conversation. Tweet us with the hashtag Barbershop Show. Right now we're talking about Chicago in 2017, sort of New Year's resolutions, I guess. What do you do for 2017 to make things better? And nobody has – I mean, we have serious problems. The pension funding is a real situation. Schools, just all of these problems that exist. And also, if we could reflect on this for a moment, now there's a lot of discussion about elections. For Bruce Rauner, the governor, it'll be 2018 for the next election and 2019 for Rahm Emanuel. And both of these people at this point are gearing up financially for the next election. So your thoughts on that, Ben?
Well, money drives politics in the state of Illinois. Richard, I know you know this already, and it's pretty staggering that Bruce Rauner's kicked in, what is it, $50 million to his campaign. We're 2 years out, so the Democrats are trying to respond by encouraging their own billionaires to run. And I think when you just have this money just get thrown around, it's as though the voters don't even matter. You know what I'm saying? We're just pieces on a chessboard that get moved around. And I saw this to a certain degree with the revelations from Mayor Emanuel's emails. I don't know if you took the time to plow through those, and I don't hold it against you if you didn't, because I wasted a better chunk of a day reading them. But it's
one of the emails he got beat up about for saying that in eliminating health care for city workers, that's a way to help, you know, resolve the budget issue.
Yeah, Now that's a perfect point. The man, so it was some wealthy donor, had access to Rahm's email, sent him an email pushing him, saying, I want you to cut harder on the pensions. Well, a lot of people get pensions, live in the city of Chicago. So this is a form of investing in the city of Chicago. It's not just like they're throwing the money in the ocean or the Lake Michigan. You're like pouring money in people's pockets, and they spend it in the Chicago. So it's a direct investment. And he wanted Rahm to pull back on the pensions and cut pensions. Rahm said, I can't do it because of the Supreme Court. So the guy started taunting Rahm in the email. He's like, oh, you're Mr. Mayor, you're Mr. Bad Guy. You're going to let a Supreme Court. Could you imagine if Karen Lewis had talked to Rahm that way? You know what I'm saying? And Rahm came back and he said, I'll have you know that I cut the health benefits of the pensioners. So it's right. like That's making how- poor middle class or working class people pay even more for their health. So,
yeah, no, the problem, what's happening now is that you have these very, very rich people in charge of everything, and they have no connection, no relationship to your average citizen.
Yeah, and that's really at the heart of the issue. We talk about campaign funding. We talk about who's in charge. And, you know, these New Year's resolutions, which sound a lot like campaign promises, which are soon forgotten. And the folks who suffer most are the people who are on the street, the people right. who live in neighborhoods like North Lawndale and West and East Garfield and Austin and Chatham and so on. And I think that they are lost in terms of their voice is what's lost. And even in the media, they're yeah. the voices that we right. don't hear.
Right.
I want to talk about a couple of personal issues. One is one of the personal issues with John Fountain is your response. Somebody who... dogged you out about mm-hmm. your, you know, questioning whether or not you're black enough, right. saying that you're responding to your white bosses at the newspaper, and you wrote a piece about that, which was pretty aggressive.
Well, I think if you respond to me in a personal email or you attack me, I still got West Side in me, so I'm coming back.
Don't
you.
Try it, right?
You know, measured response, but I think the truth is. One of the things for me as a journalist who is black is that we know as black journalists that within the newsrooms, we wage battles throughout our career, whether it's fighting for certain kinds of stories or being able to cover stories. And so to question my voice and my commitment to my people or to question my integrity or character as a journalist who happens to be black, and to say that I won't challenge my white bosses, you don't know who I am, and you don't know what we are, what we face. I'm not whining as a black journalist, but that's just the reality.
Well, your response will let that person know that there is a response to that claim. Race is always an issue in Chicago in one way or another. Now, Ben Jarofsky wrote a piece recently about Craig Hodges, who used to be with the Chicago mm-hmm. Bulls. And it's a basketball story, but it really isn't. It was a thing about race. Craig Hodges, as you recall, he sort of stood up and said, "I'm black. I want to do some things that are black oriented." And while nobody will say it, he got blackballed, and he yeah. was still viable as a player.
Right? Yes, thanks for the shout out on the story, Rich. It's one of my favorite stories of the year. And he was at. It was 1992. The Bulls had just won their second championship. Craig Hodges was the three-time defending. Three-point shooting champion. He was probably the best three-point shooter of his time, right there with Larry Bird, and nobody would hire him. So I don't know what else to call it, you know. He would have been I mean, I'm going back in time showing my age here. I'm older than everybody at this table, I think, maybe Richard.
Funny.
The New York Knicks could have used Craig Hodges.
A tremendous three-point shooter.
Yeah, he's a great three-point shooter. Pat Riley and the Knicks and Ewing, they could have used Craig Hodges to beat the Bulls in 93. They didn't hire him. They lost to the Bulls. So there's a consequence for at least one team there. But I think it's pretty outrageous that Craig Hodges could not get an offer from another team.
He was tagged as somebody who was too black. He went to sat with Farrakhan and did some other things. And, he pointed out, and you pointed out in your article, people said, well, he's a Muslim, not that it should make a difference, but he really wasn't. He explored all religions. And got about a minute left.
Okay. Years ago, I was tagged as the troublemaker at the Tribune.
I remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just because I was outspoken and challenged the editor on some very substantive stuff about black folks. For example, he said there are only two types of blacks in the newsroom. Those who are superstars, and those are there for affirmative action. Now, if you applied that to white reporters, how would that sound?
Well, I arrived at the Tribune in your shadow, yeah. And I became the troublemaker. Yeah,
right. And they won't even hire me.
And they should.
A round table of troublemakers, no question about it. All right, stay tuned to the Barbershop Show, produced by Vocalo. Coming up after the break, we're going to hear about Brown Sugar Bakery. Stephanie Hart is the owner of Brown Sugar Bakery. It's become famous for its sweet treats on the south side of Chicago. We'll be right back.
Who's gonna do it if I don't? Sick and tired of feeling sick and tired of.
This ain't heaven, help us.
They say my words might get me fired.
This ain't heaven, help us.
What a terrifying time to raise our voices.
This ain't heaven, help us.
But see, I'm not left with many more choices.
This ain't heaven, help us.
I gotta put it into action.
Action,
action,
action.
Doing it A to Z until I set myself free.
Action,
oh, action,
action.
I don't care if you refuse to see.
I gotta put it into action.
Action,
action, action.
Consider this a sign of an emergency.
Action,
action,
action, action.
Who's gonna do it if I don't do it? So my brains are filled with fear.
This ain't heaven, help us.
So I feel the heat as night comes near.
This ain't heaven, help us.
Oh, A-C-T-I-O-N.
This ain't heaven, help us.
Please don't stop if you're really my friend.
This ain't heaven, help us.
I gotta put it into action.
You just heard Action by Mavis Staples from her latest album titled Living on a High Note. Welcome back to the Barbershop Show, brought to you by Vocalo. My name is Richard Steele. We're at Carter's Barbershop in Chicago's North Lawndale neighborhood. Well, here's a sweet story that we want to tell you about today. There's a Brown Sugar Bakery on the south side of Chicago, which I'm in frequently, as a matter of fact. And we have the owner, Stephanie Hart, who's with us. The Brown Sugar Bakery has become famous for its sweet treats, cakes and cupcakes and banana pudding, which I also love.
Yeah.
On Chicago's south side of Chicago, and now with a brand new location at Navy Pier. Welcome to the Barbershop.
Thank you, and happy birthday.
Thank you so much. So you've got cake for my birthday?
Yeah, I'm going to need to get you a cake for your 75th birthday. That's exciting.
Fantastic. Listen, I'm sharing that with my journalist friends who are also here, so we're going to deal with that. Let me ask you a question, Stephanie. Your story is really interesting in that, as I recall it, when you got into this business, you had never been in the business of a bakery or baking stuff to sell or any of that. How did you get into this business?
As I'm greedy, I wanted a cake that my grandmother made me all the time. It was a pineapple coconut cake. And traveling around, going to different bakeries, I couldn't get that taste. And I really wanted it. So I had to create it. And then other people liked it.
And so, I mean, but going from that part to the idea of I can actually start a business, do this in volume, and make it for other people, that's a big leap.
You know, I think that the leap was not that far. I wanted to be continuing business. I was in a technology business. That business was waning down with the onslaught of huge companies getting into the software development space. And this was just easy and fun and so nice. It was like a relief from being in business meetings to putting something sweet in someone's mouth. It was an instant gratification. You know right away if they like it. Technology, you've got to wait. It's going to break later. This was awesome.
What'd you do in the technology business?
I did software development and technical personnel.
From software development to a bakery. Okay.
But they're really kind of the same because the baking part of cooking is really kind of scientific. You know, it's not as creative as, you know, just throw a little bit of this and throw a little bit of that. You kind of have to really think about how you're going to approach a cake, what's going to go in it. And to get it to taste the same, it has to be exactly the same every time. So it's a little more of the science.
All right, so the whole process, though, I mean, so now you have this idea, and you say, well, I can do this, and other people like it, and so I'm going to do it, I'm going to sort of not mass produce it, but produce it, you know, for people who will come into my store, then the process of selecting a location, all the stuff, the financials that go with it, you know, the There are a lot of things in business that you have to know about to go into business in the first place. But in the baking business, there are issues of, especially when you're using sweet stuff, there are issues of trying to keep the bugs out, all kinds of stuff. So how did you learn all of that stuff? How did you go about that?
I think you go about that a little bit at a time. I think that having a business background just did help, because I had always been in some type of business. Being in marketing and selling, all of that helps. Going into specifically the food business was sort of a relief for me. I got to deal with the end customer instead of some kind of corporation. And so you want, number one, you know you can satisfy them. And then all the other problems, you're going to have all those problems in any business. The new problems you just ride with. I think that I was really, really blessed on the community that drew me to them, which is, you know, Chatham. I'm on 75th Cree Street. Some people call it Greater Grand Crossing. There's a lot of different names for the neighborhood.
By the way, you're right next door to the WBEZ studio.
Well, now that's
on the south side of Chicago.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I heard you guys were looking, and I'm like, are you kidding? Come next door to me. This will be fun. So we have a great community of solid entrepreneurs, and the street drew me. I drove down the street. I'm like, I want to be here with people who've been in business for 60 years and 35 years, and we have barbershops. I'm down the street from a barbershop, and those kinds of things breed a community, and they breed a kind of togetherness, and I'm excited about being on 75th Street.
Tell you a little story about you're talking about Mars Barbershop.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
One of my first jobs ever, when I was about 12, and Mars Barbershop was in the 7500 block of Prairie at that point, before it moved to where it is now.
Right.
And I used to shine shoes and sweep up the barbershop.
Oh, I believe
way
it.
Back in the day,
see?
You know, because
they've been there so long.
I lived in Chatham at that point. I lived at 74th and Indiana when
and
I was a
still
kid.
There. They
yeah,
are still there.
Still there. But the other thing, though, in terms of location is a great location. You are directly across the street from Lem's Barbecue. So
could
tell me about
you
that.
Believe it. So amazing. First of all, to be able to smell barbecue and peach cobbler every day, I mean, that is just like the life, right? I mean,
yeah.
So I don't have all that much to complain about. But Lem's Barbecue, being a food business that's been in the community for over 50 years, they stopped selling dessert when I came. I mean,
really?
Do you know? So go across the street after you get your barbecue. Go across the street to Brown Sugar. What an awesome thing to do. What a solid foundation, how that just solidified me and helped me in the early days of coming to that block. It was amazing.
How did you all come to that conclusion? Did you have a discussion with them, or
absolutely
did they just say?
Absolutely not. They just did it. And one day they came in the bakery to get some sweet potato pie, and they said, you know, we stopped selling desserts. Yours are good, so we're sending everybody over here.
Really?
And I'm like, really? So I love 75th Street. I do.
So in terms of, you know, advertising, for your advertising your business, obviously, you know, people do a lot of things online today. That's a way to get a lot of information and news out.
Mm-hmm.
But you had a new business, advertising in media, whether it's newspaper, radio, or television, is very expensive. So that's not something that you did, right?
No, but what's interesting is I've just had an interesting time on 75th Street. So it's a fun business to be in, and I think those kind of things, I've been really blessed to get picked up and reported. So I'm kind of good at what I do. I'm not bragging, but I make a good cake.
Yeah, you are. You're bragging. You know, it's okay.
So I've been lucky to get exposure because I do make a really good cake. It's
sure.
Basic. It's simple. It's nothing fancy about it, but it's solid. It does what it's supposed to do, which is satiate your sweet tooth. So I kind of have that down. That's gotten me a lot of publicity. I've been blessed to get picked as I think it was America's Best Baker by Steve Harvey, and get that kind of publicity. That was like outrageous. And then they followed up Navy Pier, that whole thing. So people write about these other things that I happen to be around. I'm just really lucky that way.
I want to talk about the Navy Pier thing in a minute. If you're just joining us, this is the Barbershop Show produced by Vocalo. Right now we're talking about a fantastic business called Brown Sugar Bakery, a black business in the black community, and now at Navy Pier, which has become famous for its sweet treats and now it's available to people from everywhere.
Isn't that exciting? I'm so excited about
Pier.
That.
So the Navy Pier thing, you know, when I was told about that, you and I talked about that when I came to the store, and I went, whoa, that's big time. Because, and I said to you, honestly, I said, you know, to get into Navy Pier and be African-American, usually requires clout. I mean, you got to know somebody, and you said, well, it didn't go that way. It just kind of came up. How did it come up?
I'm literally the new peers. I think their term is the people's peer. And they were reaching out in the community to try to find businesses that represented Chicago. And they thought that I was one of them, that I was a good representation of a Chicago business. Go figure. I'm like, really? Okay. And we rolled with that punch. Now, I will tell you, you told me in the beginning that that would be tough. And that is probably preparing for that took me probably twice as long as the average business. But I'm excited about the opportunity to export from 75th Street, to export my product from my community, to showcase what we do throughout the city and still manufacture it in my community. I'm so excited about that.
So yeah. Tell me some of the things you had to do. Because, you know, in terms of getting into Navy Pier and all the rules and regulations, when you and I talked about it, you were just scratching your head going, I can't even believe it, but I'm going to do this. But it really is a long process, because I remember our conversation from when you first told me that it was going to happen between then and then, of course, when that part of the pier was developing at that point, but also new businesses coming in, and all you have to do to get in the pier, the regulations are enormous, right?
The regulations are enormous. The pier is every I has to be dotted, every T has to be crossed. And that was a lot for me, because I'm kind of a little hippie-ish when it comes to that. I want to bend the rules typically, and this isn't that kind of scenario. But all in all, I think it's made me a better business. I'm down there competing with the world-class businesses of Chicago, so I'm excited about that. Financing was most interesting, and ultimately we got an angel that came in to help us. Yeah, that's what ultimately happened. I wasn't able to secure traditional financing. So that grew. It was really scary for a while. It was really a roller coaster ride, for real.
So if it's not too personal, how did you go about that in terms of getting the angel to support the business? And does that still leave you in control of your business?
Oh, I'm still in control of the business, but I do take on a partner, and that's also exciting, because now I have a partner that can help grow the business to the next level. I have big dreams, but it's really kind of a little difficult to facilitate some of those dreams from the place that I was coming from. So you need a kind of recognition that comes with being at Navy Pier. Now all of a sudden people take the same cake that I've been making a little more seriously. So there's other opportunities that are around that. How do I move out to get this product national exposure now? So that's having that angel, the person, come into my business is allowing me to really look at the next 10 years and becoming a real corporation, moving from a mom and pop concept to actually a real business where people will know Brown Sugar nationwide.
Which is an interesting thing that you've said, because as you point out, you sort of the mentally the hippie approach to doing things, we'll see what happens, but from a corporate standpoint, it has to be more specific and more direct. Although these guys who've created these software companies, they still wear gym shoes and t-shirts, so... Yeah.
That's an interesting thing that you picked. So specifically around that, the software companies that made that transition, they might have on the gym shoes, but these are serious business people. I mean, you think about how some of these huge things, or even something like Facebook, was created, and you look at the creator and you say, he's teaching class at Stanford also. Didn't he have some kind of Harvard background? He's a businessman. He's not a hippie.
As we talked to Stephanie Hart, the owner of Brown Sugar Bakery. So what about, this idea of keeping the business in the community? There are some people who will say, well, now that, as you become successful, and I have no doubt based on the product itself that I know about intimately because it's great stuff, that as you become a bigger company, there are people who would have concerns about, will you move out of the community? Will you not be on 75th Street across from Lem's? And would you say, well, I'm expanding now, I think I'm going to move downtown or to the north side? Not just as one of your locations, but staying in the community. How important is that to you?
Oh, no, that's everything. The product that I created, the love that went into that caramel cake that you like or that pineapple coconut. That came from my grandmother, my auntie. Those ladies live on those blocks around that business. So the best critique for me is when, you know, a lady comes in that can't even carry her cake out to the car because she's elderly and, you know, she's come from the South and made that migration and validates my product. I'm always going to be where that is because that's how I continue to grow. It's that vein that I take the creativity from to create the product that I create. So I'm always going to stay. But at the same time, I think that the opportunity that's in front of me is the ability to grow 75th Street and grow a business that can do the things like employ more people in the community. I might not be able to manufacture on 75th Street, but I can manufacture close by in my community where I can still employ those same people that could help me create this product.
And what I've also seen in your bakery is that some local business people, you'll create a corner for people to sell things like, you know, jewelry that they make and stuff like that upon occasion. And so that incorporates other businesses, small businesses, and people have meetings, you know, can have a meeting there at your place. So that's kind of a good thing. Let me tell you this before we wrap up. I must include this story. This is so bizarre. Burglars break into the bakery, steal only the caramel cakes, and then sell them. what was that about?
You know, that was one of those real
a couple of months ago, right?
Well, actually, that was another break-in. I've had three in 1 year. I don't know what kind of cake they think I'm making.
What about
at the
this caramel cake robbery?
That was amazing. That was just a stunner. When you look around and the computer's there and the cash register is there and you're confused as to why your window got broken, and then you see the trail of cake, and then you look around and notice your inventory is gone. I can't really tell you how that feels except for super shocked. I mean, I sat down. I still felt violated. But I'm wondering, who is crazy enough to steal cake?
And it was just the caramel cake, right?
Just anything with caramel on it is what they took. Anything that had caramel on it was out the door. And it took the police officer.
Our reporters love this story. They're sitting over there going, what, are you serious?
I'm serious.
And then the people who stole the cakes. There was reported by another local business that the people were selling the cakes
and
on the street.
And I went to that businessman, and I said, who buys cake? And he looked at me like I was dumb, and he said, but it was brown sugar cake. I was like, oh, my God. Who buys cake on the street? That's crazy.
You know, part of that is a good marketing tool. The cake is so good that the bad guys. And the other thing is, when they broke in the story that I read, they didn't trash the store. They didn't break anything up. They just took the cake to
eat.
They were
trying to keep the thing to be neat and tidy. They did not mess up the store at all. They didn't. Literally, if you really, you had to look close to figure out what happened besides the broken window. It took, like I said, the police officer, the detective, he was like, what happened? And he was the one to identify that the stuff was missing from the case. It was crazy.
Unbelievable. Listen, Stephanie Hart, it's a pleasure to talk to you. And I must say that since you've been at Navy Pier, every time I walk by where your space is, there are people, you know,
it's
buying
fun.
Stuff. You know,
it's fun.
It's pretty incredible. And you've provided some employment for some people, too. And that's a cool thing. Stephanie Hart, owner of Brown Sugar Bakery, which has become famous for its sweet treats, cakes and cupcakes and banana pudding on Chicago's South Side. And now a brand new location at Navy Pier. And you bought a cake today, so
yes.
After we conclude, my journalist friends and I are going to celebrate my 75th year on the planet by eating some of your
Yay.
Cake.
Thank you.
They like that. They like that. And the barbershop.
Yes.
T is the guy who runs this barbershop, and he's game. He can hardly wait to do that. You've been listening to The Barbershop Show, bringing you Shop Talk from Carter's Barbershop, located at 3622 West Cermak in Chicago's North Lawndale neighborhood. If you have any comments on today's show, please give us a call at 888-635-1112 and press 2 to leave a message. I want to thank our earlier guests, Mavis Staples and Gene Chandler, big names in the music business. And also our thanks to Ben Jarofsky, Monroe Anderson, John W. Fountain, and Stephanie Hart for being with us today. It's been a real pleasure to have everybody on the show. The Barbershop is brought to you by Vocalo, sister station to WBEZ. Sarah Lou is here with us. Sarah Lou, I must say this, she was with this show originally, and she sort of walked us through it. She used to do everything. She used to be the producer. She used to write all the scripts, and she was the engineer as well. And so it's a pleasure to see you. I know you're moving on to some better things. And so thank you so much for spending your time with us. Our show today was produced by executive producer Ayanna Contreras. Our managing director is Sylvia Rivera. Colin Ashby Bobbitt was our remote engineer. The Barbershop Show has a podcast. You can find it in the WBEZ iTunes store and download it for free. So for everybody here at Carter's Barbershop, my name is Richard Steele. Thank you for listening.
Yay.